compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Friday morning. I had to check what day it is today. Cyrus, it's almost the weekend.
I was waiting for that.
Good morning, Friday morning. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. We're going to be going to your phone calls here in just a little bit. The number is 888-914-9149. This caught my eye yesterday insofar as it has to do with our military. Now, perhaps you served in the military. Perhaps you have a family member who served or is serving in the military. That's probably true for most Americans. Or at the very least, you know somebody who's serving in the military. And if you're a Christian, the chances are pretty good that the person you know is also a Christian. Well, this caught my eye because a Marine Corps officer he's publicly warning Congress against classifying Christians in the military as quote-unquote religious extremists. Now, this is from the Epoch Times. We'll get a link to this article for you. And it sent a chill down my spine when I realized that what he is alleging that is going on in the military, and I've seen some glimpses here and there of things that seem to suggest that what he's saying is true. And so this story helped me to kind of get a bigger picture look at what seems to be happening in the military, at least at some levels, which strikes me as a kind of purge of those in the military, whether in the officer corps or enlisted, who are conservative. And even worse, if they are committed Christians, they're in the crosshairs, it seems, because lately, anyway, especially since the January 6th attack on the Capitol in Washington, D.C., there's a move afoot to try to find extremists in various sectors of society, including the military. So here's how this is being reported as of yesterday. A slide used in a Department of Defense DOD training manual identifies Catholics and evangelical Christians as quote-unquote religious extremists, along with members of the KKK, Al-Qaeda, and Hamas. This according to a Marine Corps officer. First Liberty also obtained a screenshot of an unclassified slide from a U.S. Army training manual. The slide is entitled Religious Extremism, and it purports to identify religious extremists. This is from Michael Berry, who testified before the House Armed Services Committee in a hearing on the 24th of March, just a couple of days ago. And the hearing was under the title Extremism in the Military. Berry is general counsel to the First Liberty Institute in Texas, a public interest law firm that specializes in First Amendment and religious freedom cases. He's also an officer in the Marine Corps. He's in the reserves, that is. He presented his testimony in his capacity as a civilian. He told the committee, quote, included among those listed are Al-Qaeda, Hamas, the KKK, as groups that use or advocate violence to accomplish their objectives and are therefore rightly classified as extremists, but also included are evangelical Christians and Catholics, who most assuredly do not advocate violence. Surely the fact that evangelical Christians and Catholics hold fast to a millennia-old view on marriage and human sexuality does not make them extremists who are unfit to serve. At a time of turmoil and instability, during which our nation faces many external threats, this message, he says, is inappropriate and offensive to our service members and those they defend. The training manual that Berry refers to is used in Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's recently ordered stand down to identify and root out extremism in the U.S. military. Austin's order came in the wake of the January 6th breach of the U.S. Capitol, in which some of the participants were military veterans. Austin said in a Department of Defense video explaining his reasons for the stand down that all military members in each of the branches are required to view that there is not a single doubt in my mind that you take seriously your oath to the Constitution and that you serve this country with honor and dignity and character. Even so, according to Austin in the video, the stand down is needed because of, quote, extremism and extremist ideology, views and conduct that run counter to everything that we believe in. Austin claimed in the video that the presence of extremist views is not new to our country and sadly, it is not new to our military. He didn't provide in the video any examples of such individuals. The training materials used in Austin's stand down and presented by Barry during the hearing purported to present credible descriptions of extremist ideologies, conduct, reasoning, and identifying characteristics. Now, pay close attention to this here. Committee Chairman Adam Smith, the Democrat of Washington, told a hearing in his opening statement, quote, "If you serve in the military, you pledge an oath to the U.S. Constitution and to the laws of this country. If you disagree with that Constitution and you disagree with the laws of this country so strongly that you no longer think our government is legitimate, then you have no business serving in the U.S. military and you should get out now." The two issues were particularly two particularly prominent issues in witness testimony and committee members' comments: the lack of credible data about the extent of any extremism in the ranks, and the lack of what constitutes impermissible expression of views and actions on behalf of those views. Representative Mike Rogers, a Republican from Alabama, the panel's top Republican, told the hearing at the outset that, quote, "It is important to point out that we lack any concrete evidence that violent extremism is as rife in the military as some commentators claim." I'm going to pause here. So hearken back to January 6th and the melee that took place at the U.S. Capitol. It was terrible. It shouldn't have happened. Rightly condemned, etc. And it seems to me that what's happening here is because a number of these people, and how large the number is, I don't know. I don't think it's been publicized yet. But a number of the people who were closely involved at the very center of this storming of the Capitol building were identified as either active duty or retired military, some active duty law enforcement, some retired law enforcement. And this seems to me to be the impetus behind this witch hunt. And that's what I'm calling it, for lack of a better term right now. The military scouring its ranks to find out who might be, you know, committed to things like, I don't know, traditional marriage. That's extremism in their view. So Rogers, the aforementioned Republican from Alabama, says extremism was a factor in the separation of only 9 soldiers from the U.S. Army in 2020. He noted that since 2018, 17 Marines have been separated for extremism, gang, or separatist activities. That's 17 out of 200,000. While I agree that this number ought to be zero, he said, this is far from the largest military justice issue facing our armed forces. Earlier this year, 151 overwhelmingly liberal organizations, including Human Rights Watch, the ACLU, the Southern Poverty Law Center, one of the worst, urged Congress not to expand domestic terrorism charges. The organization said, "We urge you to oppose any new domestic terrorism charges, the creation of a list of designated domestic terrorist organizations, or other expansion of existing terrorism-related authorities." So this was kind of an about-face. The committee heard from only two other witnesses: Audrey Kurth Cronin, an American University professor of international security, and Lisa Brooks, the chief of staff for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a liberal advocacy group often criticized by conservatives for defining extremism so broadly as to include conventional political groups that are clearly not extremists. Now, I would argue, this is me speaking here, that groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center are themselves the extremists, the extreme left fringe of what is already a very leftward tilting country nowadays. They're sort of at the far edge of that, the lunatic fringe, if you ask me. The newest Republican member of the committee, Representative Pat Fallon of Texas, pointed out that, quote, recently the New York Post, The New York Times, Politico, NPR, and The New Yorker magazine, just to name a few, skewered the Southern Poverty Law Center for, among other things, corruption, harassment, racism, and a widening credibility gap. Fallon also noted that Cronin claimed 37 of those arrested in connection with the January 6th attack on the Capitol were either U.S. military veterans or reservists. There are 18 million U.S. military veterans. 34 were rioters. This means that 17,999,966 of us were not. That's 1 out of 529,000, Fallon pointed out. Smith rejected Fallon's comments, however, as logically absurd, because veterans arrested during or after the January 6th riot don't represent the full scope of the problem, he says. We don't know how large the problem is. That's why we're having this hearing, according to Smith. Cronin told the committee in response to a question from Representative Jim Langevin, a Democrat from Rhode Island, that recruitment efforts by extremist groups targeting active and retired military individuals is indeed becoming an increasing problem. Asked by Representative Joe Wilson for his view on the issue of on the use of lists of prohibited organizations, he said they can be dangerous. Labeling evangelical Christians and Catholics as extremists is opening Pandora's box. Representative Mike Waltz, a Republican of Florida, expressed concern that a Department of Defense effort against extremism will play into the hands of the Chinese Communist Party and its efforts to damage the U.S. image overseas. Waltz says, there is an active propaganda campaign being prosecuted by the Chinese Communist Party right now, attempting to portray our country as an evil, racist hellscape with no authority to lecture them on human rights. I worry that we may be playing into our adversaries' hands, and I do worry it will undermine our ability to fight and win wars in the future. In conclusion, the article says Smith at the hearing said, there are demagogues on both sides. He says he is very concerned about overreactions. And lastly, he says, if we are targeting people and shutting them off from jobs and everything for something they said 20 years ago, there's no reference point, no structure to that, and it becomes just this excuse to shove your point of view down somebody's throat. Worth keeping an eye on, if you ask me, because obviously our military is what stands between us and all the dangers that are out there in the world, not to mention some of those that are here in this country. And so the very thought of an ideological purge of the ranks of the officer corps and the enlisted ranks because they just don't like maybe some conservative or traditional views, that's a very frightening thought indeed. And I'm hopeful that there are enough conservative-leaning officers, maybe at the general level, who will be able to thwart this. We'll see what happens. But this is a whole new era now, and it's a topic worth keeping your eye on. 888-914-9149. I also thought this was interesting, and this is sort of, you know, it's government-related, but it's not military-related. PJ Media is reporting that some Biden staffers, who I guess in their background checks they disclosed that they had smoked pot, they got fired. Now, they raise the question, does this mean that Kamala Harris could be next? She's obviously our vice president. The Biden White House has asked several staffers who admitted to previously smoking marijuana to resign and others to work remotely in a move that was apparently a shock to many. And this is according to the Daily Beast. Dozens of young White House staffers have been suspended, asked to resign, or placed on a remote work program due to past marijuana use, frustrating staffers who were pleased by initial indications from the Biden administration that recreational use of cannabis would not be immediately disqualifying for would-be personnel, according to three people familiar with the situation. By the way, I've got to say, I have a feeling deep inside, oh yeah, I have a feeling that most all of those people are either smoking pot or have smoked pot. And this is probably true of a goodly number of people in the previous administration. I'm not just singling out the current regime. Previous regimes, I think, also have had this issue in their ranks. But here we are with this current administration. If I had to guess, I would say that it would be the minority of people who never smoked pot. The policy has even affected staffers whose marijuana use was exclusive to one of the 14 states and the District of Columbia where cannabis is legal. Sources familiar with the matter also said that a number of young staffers were either put on probation or canned because they revealed their past marijuana use in an official document they filled out as part of the lengthy background check for a position in the White House. In some cases, staffers were informally told by transition higher-ups ahead of formally joining the administration that they would likely overlook some past marijuana use, only to be asked later to resign. The problem appears to stem from security clearance regulations that vary from agency to agency. The Daily Beast notes that to work in the FBI, an applicant can't have any marijuana use in the last 3 years, and the NSA only requires 1 year. So if you stop smoking dope a year ago, you're clean enough to get into the NSA. You're clean enough, I guess, to get the high-level security clearance. To allow more people with a history of pot smoking to join the team, the White House decided to waive the requirement of receiving top-secret clearance to work in the executive office of the president for some candidates. In response, White House spokesperson Press Secretary Jen Psaki circled back, having indicated the current administration is much more permissive about past marijuana use than previous administrations. The number of staffers who are no longer employed is relatively small, she said. They have not disclosed how many were denied jobs because of their disclosures. But where it gets interesting is the connection to Kamala Harris. It says White House staff must submit to an FBI background check, which includes interviews with family and friends. Before agents conduct the assessment, the candidates must fill out a form. The most significant complaint is that the candidates were not told disclosing prior marijuana use could impact their employment. This information was probably not provided to encourage honesty. If the candidate is not upfront and a relative or associate tells the FBI something different, there are potential legal penalties for lying to the agency. I wonder what this means, the author of the article says. I wonder what this means, she says, for Vice President Kamala Harris, who famously talked about her love of smoking weed and listening to Tupac. That must have been much longer than 3 years ago, and Tupac didn't cut an album yet. Still, no, he's been gone for a long time. Still, knowing what her honest answer about past drug use was would be interesting, considering how many pot smokers she sent to jail. In reality, until federal and state laws align regarding marijuana use, the perceptions of how acceptable it is in terms of employment at the federal level will remain an issue. Federal law is supposed to set the minimum standards, so marijuana is still an illegal drug. State laws are only supposed to enhance, not contradict, federal law. It is not surprising that younger candidates may be surprised that there are regulations about recency of use if they come from states where it has been legalized, including Washington, D.C., which is not a state, obviously. So I find that interesting. Maybe a bit of a double standard. Bill Clinton, didn't he say that he did, but he never inhaled? Wasn't that what he said, Cyrus? I think that's that was
right,
the...
Yeah. I never inhaled. I can't do it, but yeah.
I never inhaled. Yeah, but I never inhaled. Did you smoke pot? Yeah, but I never inhaled.
Never inhaled.
Yeah. Do you believe that?
No comment.
Nobody believed that.
I don't know what the meaning of the... What is the meaning of the word no?
No, he said it depends on what... How did he say it? Depends on what the meaning of is.
That's what it was. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. You knew exactly what I was talking about. Yeah.
I don't think anybody believed when Bill Clinton said he had smoked marijuana. I believe that part. But when he said he never inhaled, nobody believed that. So this is just interesting because, you know, I don't really think, as far as I know anyway, that to be vice president, so Mike Pence, for example, president, whether it's Bill Clinton or Donald Trump or now Joe Biden, I don't know, just to be president per se, if you have to have a background check. Now, I understand, of course, that Joe Biden probably has had a million background checks. True story, Cyrus. Then we'll press on to some phone calls. One of my daughters, she worked for the George W. Bush administration. So she worked in the faith-based office. And she worked in Washington, D.C. in a building catty corner to the White House. And she was in the White House fairly frequently. She sent us pictures fairly frequently of her being on the White House lawn when Marine One, the helicopter, was taking off. So she'd be part of the group of people assembled, staffers, and the president would walk by and get on the helicopter and off he'd go. So she was in the White House, and she had this job for, it seems to me, about, if I'm not mistaken, about 2 years, maybe a year and a half, 2 years. She had to get a top secret clearance. And she's our little homeschooled girl, you know. She had never had really, she lived a relatively sheltered experience of life. So the first thing that happened when she had her security clearance was the FBI agent, I think he was FBI, he contacts me, he says, hey, I'm, you know, agent so-and-so, FBI, I'd like to talk to you about your daughter's security clearance. I said, fine. So where do you want to meet? I named a place, so we met there. This guy was no nonsense. Didn't even crack a smile. No small talk. So we sat at this booth in a restaurant for maybe 20 minutes. I don't think it was much longer than that. And he just asked me a series of questions about her. You know, what can you tell us about her? And, you know, I gave a glowing report because that's true. So then he told me he was going to do this. So it wasn't like a surprise or anything. So then he parked his car, maybe in our driveway. And he spent the next like 3 or 4 hours on our street going door to door, literally door to door. He must have visited 20 houses. And he'd knock on the door, ring the bell. Person would come for, hi, I'm, you know, agent so-and-so from the FBI. I'm doing a background check on one of the Madrid girls. And what can you tell me about this family? What can you tell me about this girl? And it was extremely thorough. I'm sure that behind the scenes they went through bank records and phone logs and who knows what else they combed through. I don't know. But I was impressed, quite frankly, that they went to that level of scrutiny to go door to door and just ask people, you know, do you have any dirt on this person? Do you have any dirt on this family? Is there anything going on that we should know about? And of course, she sailed through with flying colors and got her top secret security clearance. So she went from learning school at the kitchen table as a homeschool girl to having a top secret security clearance at the White House.
That is cool. When was this again?
George W. Bush.
So now I wonder if they would bother with that and they would just check this, your social media print.
They would definitely check that now.
Yeah.
But yeah, that
I wonder
could,
if they still go door to door.
That, see, that's a thing that didn't exist, say, 10, 15 years ago.
Right,
at least I don't think it did.
No.
But, oh boy, now.
Now it does.
Oh gosh, yes. Well, I tell you what, it looks like we've reached the point of no return. We have to take a break. We'll come back. We'll do phone calls. Then, oh, come on, Cyrus. All right. Pot related. I get it. 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Marijuana free. We'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Cyrus, I know that you think you're being clever.
I am so clever.
You're so clever, but I mean, I see right through this. I'm looking through you, as the word, as it says.
All right.
So, no, it's good, though. I like the fact that you try to be topical. That's good.
What my goal is to make you laugh on the air. So if I can make you laugh, if I say something in your ear or I write something in our chat box that makes you laugh while you're doing something else, I consider that a personal victory.
A win.
That is a win.
Well, you are good at what you do. I will say that.
You make it fun.
But I'm on to you as far as the...
I know you are.
All right. 888-914-9149. Let's start with Mark in Chicago. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, how you doing, Patrick? Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hey, I enjoy your show. The whole thing with our culture, it's gone crazy with holding people to a higher standard all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you see, if this person smoked marijuana, you know, you're fired. Oh, you're fired. You mm-hmm. know, I tell you, the concept of forgiveness is just, it's long gone. There's
right.
no forgiveness. There's no, and I think in that all comes with denial of sin. You know, when you don't have any forgiveness in your heart, you can't forgive something if you don't recognize that there's sin. And people just don't recognize sin. They just have their own personal conscience, and they don't realize, you know, what the Holy Spirit is all about. And I think that just creates no dialogue between the left and the right. There's no talk, even the right, you know, they claim that they're tolerant, and but I don't hear them talking about forgiveness too much, you know.
Well, let me, you know, that's an interesting take you got, and I don't entirely disagree with you, but I do kind of disagree with you, and here's why. My take on it, Mark, is that the left has their own list of things they think are sins, and they, you know, they may be in fact sinful, or they may just be simply something that they don't like ideologically. So, for example, they don't like it if you don't go along with the gender ideology and use pronouns. They don't like that. They don't like it if somebody says, well, there really only are men and women, and men can't be women and women can't be men. They don't like it so much that they'll deplatform you from Facebook or Twitter if you dare to say that publicly. So they have their list of sins, and they're quite ready to descend upon anyone they deem to be a sinner, according to their way of looking at sin, and destroy that person. And this is the part of what you're saying that I do agree with, and that is that, especially on the left, and we see this even among, you know, some who claim to be Catholic anyway, on social media, who they talk a lot about forgiveness, but they are anything but forgiving. All they want to do is stomp on whoever they perceive to be getting out of line and destroy them and get their speaking events canceled and get them fired and get them silenced and discredited. So they evince no evidence of actual compassion or forgiveness. It's just, we're going to punish you and we're going to destroy you. Now, they've learned that from their leftist, you know, role models in social media and elsewhere, and they carry through with that. There's no question that this happens. So I agree with your point that in certain sectors, there is absolutely no forgiveness if you have infringed upon the things that they deem to be sinful, and they're implacable in their effort to exact retribution. So that is, you know, clearly something that we have to avoid. We have to push back against. But one way of doing it, seems to me, Mark, is by being forgiving, by being compassionate, and doing the things that Jesus wants us to do.
Yeah, you know, Patrick, the left portrays himself as being the tolerant one and pulling for the underdog. And it's just like with, if you look at blacks, minorities in the world, you know, they basically, you know, they don't talk about the families. You know, they talk about how they're victims all the time. And
maybe I didn't understand you. You said blacks don't talk about the family? I don't think that's true. I'm not sure what you mean by that. Maybe I misunderstood you.
Here's what I'm saying, Patrick, is that the left doesn't talk about families, the importance of the family to the black culture. You know, what's talked about is the whole white society is racist, you know, and it really, if we continue that rhetoric, our society is not going to last, because we're going to have, slavery, for example. You have to be able to forgive people. You know, we did wrong there, and I get that, but you got to move on. If you're going to keep holding grudges against people forever, and we learn from our mistakes because we're all sinners, but there's no concept of that. It's all about what's payback, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the bigger picture, I don't think it's helpful to paint with overly broad brushes. So I would put it this way. The vocal voices that are out there, when we talk about the left and the right, sometimes it's hard to really find the right words to talk about these phenomena. But in any case, they have an agenda. They have a goal in mind. And that goal for many of them, most of them probably, is power, to gain it, to consolidate it, and to keep it. And according to the methodologies that they like to apply, in order to gain power and consolidate power, you have to agitate. You have to keep people agitated. You have to keep them angry. You have to keep them aggrieved. You have to keep them victimized, whether it's real or not real. And in order to do that, there's got to be a kind of an incessant message about how aggrieved they should be. And then once the power has been consolidated, then the only way to keep it is you have to perpetuate that. So this is a delicate balance here, because on the one hand, there's no question but that this country has a terrible and I'm trying to choose the right word for it, a horrible, I mean, we have in our history the institution of slavery. It was legalized here. And as you know, Mark, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but we fought a civil war in which, you know, countless hundreds of thousands of men primarily died as a result of this. Yes, I know it was a states' rights issue as well, but it was fundamentally about slavery. So this country has, its entire history is permeated with this problem. And now we're seeing how that problem has resurfaced. And the problem with what you're saying in the minds of many people would be, Mark, they would say, I'm not saying this, but I know that many people would jump down your throat and saying, well, that's just your white privilege speaking. You're just trying to you know, move on. You just want to sweep things under the rug, and you're not willing to deal with the issue, and that's just your white privilege, and that's a form of racism. That's what they will tell you. So even though the point you're making has merit, it won't be heard in the larger conversation because they'll simply shout you down and say what I just said. And that's the real problem here, is that people very often, they won't hear each other anymore. They won't even bother to consider that maybe there's a point here somewhere that I should think about. You know what I'm saying? That's to me, the real roadblock that we face right now.
I think you make a lot of good points, Patrick, and I appreciate you letting me talk. And, you know, I think the trouble is, even in the media, there people are afraid to talk about black and white population trying to get together, because if they say something, they're afraid they're going to get fired from their jobs.
Yeah, that's true. It's a sorry state we've come to, Mark, and I'm glad you called. Thank you for joining the conversation. You know, Martin Luther King would be considered a racist now because of his I Have a Dream speech, in which he said that I dream of a country, a future, in which my children will be judged by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin. That's anathema to the political left. They hate that because everything now must be seen through the prism of race. Everything. And it distorts everything. And so there's no more room for somebody's philosophy like Martin Luther King's, who said the truth, and it was true then, it's true now, but in 1967, 1968, when he was saying things like that, the nation was questing for actual, genuine racial harmony, which is why what he said rings so true. But now, gosh, how often do you ever hear that phrase from Martin Luther King ever invoked in racial discussions in this country, ever? Never. Because it's diametrically opposed to the prevailing liberal extremist left narrative. That's just how it is. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Charlotte and talk to Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As someone who is constantly looking for good Catholic resources, I've come across a number of them, and thank you for what you do in your show, and thanks to Relevant Radio, which is a great resource, and I've been listening to church. There just seems to be not a divide, but confusion amongst the Catholic community between, you know, the Vatican II crowd and Novus Ordo Mass and the traditional Latin Mass.
Favorite, Colin, if you could just kind of consolidate this into a question, that would help me.
Okay, I was wondering your opinion about right now the what I find to be confusion in the Catholic community between traditionalists and the new, and I wouldn't say new, but the post-Vatican II Novus Ordo.
Okay.
And as you go around the country and attend masses throughout the country, there's a variety of different flavors, if you will.
Right, I get you. And I lived through that. So I was about 6 years old when the Mass definitively changed from the traditional Latin Mass to the Novus Ordo Mass in the wake of the Second Vatican Council. So I only have a child's memory of that change. I did have I'm telling you this, Colin, by way of background so you can understand where I'm coming from. So even though I was only six when the Mass changed from Latin to English or the vernacular, and I don't really have a clear memory of it. But it so happens that through God's providence, I guess, I was at Mission San Juan Capistrano Grammar School for several years, and that school is attached to the local parish, and Pope Paul VI had granted an indult to pastors above a certain age so that they could continue to celebrate the Mass and the other sacraments according to the traditional rite. And so I was able to serve the traditional Latin Mass as a boy in grammar school every morning, you know, the 7 a.m. Mass before I would go to school that morning. And so for me, it was a great experience for years to have that daily contact with the traditional Latin Mass, which I very much love, I very much esteem it, and to understand it in a way that many people didn't have the opportunity to do because they only came to it later, they discovered it later. So on Sundays, we would go to our Happy Clappy Parish where there were guitars and felt banners and things of that nature. And during the weeks, or I'm sorry, during the weekdays, I would be at the traditional Latin Mass. So it was an odd juxtaposition, or at least I found it so. But it was helpful to me so that I could see some things growing up that seemed very apparent to me that might not be so apparent to other people. And the first of those things is that the Mass is the Mass is the Mass. And that's something that I would offer to anybody, whether they're inclined toward the traditional Latin Mass, which I very much love, or they're inclined toward the Novus Ordo Mass. And that is that fundamentally what you are experiencing is the once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross. You're made present at the Last Supper, at Calvary, and in the heavenly sanctuary. And this is real, whether it is at a traditional Latin Mass or at a Novus Ordo Mass. Now, that doesn't mean that there may not be, and that there are, I would argue, aesthetic differences between the two, such that for many people, it seems to me, the traditional Latin Mass provides them with the aesthetic experience that heightens and intensifies the spiritual fruitfulness for them of going to Mass. Now, I know people who say the same about the Novus Ordo Mass, and I can understand that, and I can respect that. But for me, and this is part of my answer to your question, Colin, is that if we get lost in the weeds of the debate between which Mass is better, then it's unhelpful because it loses sight of the fact that regardless, it's still the Mass, and that's the focus. That should be our focus. I would also add that it seems to me that when Catholics experience the kind of vapid, somewhat empty, banal, pedestrian celebration of the Mass at their local parish, and then suddenly they experience the traditional Latin Mass, very often they're like, wow, that's a big difference. I really like that. I really like the silence. I really like the beauty of the prayers, etc. Not everybody has that experience, but many people do, including many young people who now are gravitating even more to the Latin Mass. Third thing I'll say, I myself, my wife and I, we are registered parishioners in our Diocese of Columbus, Ohio, at a regular Novus Ordo parish. So the Mass is celebrated in English. We happen to have a parish that's run by Dominican friars, so it's very traditional, but it's the vernacular. It's the Novus Ordo Mass. And although I try to get to a traditional Latin Mass whenever I have the opportunity, the day-to-day, week-to-week Masses that we attend are the Novus Ordo. So I have nothing against that. Last thing I'll say is this. The Second Vatican Council is controversial at two levels. The first level is the controversies which existed or erupted at the time of the council over the schemas, the doctrinal schemas that were the underpinnings or the original framework for the different things that the council produced, the different like the dogmatic constitution on the church or on religious liberty, etc. And at that time, there was a struggle between the traditional Catholics, Cardinal Ottaviani, for example, and there were others, who wanted the Second Vatican Council to emphasize and reiterate authentic traditional Catholic doctrine. There was also a cadre, a rather large one, in fact, and primarily from Germany, but also Austria and France and a few other places that were of a much more liberalizing bent. And so you can see, even in the eyewitness accounts, so for example, by Father Ralph Wiltkin, who wrote the book called The Rhine Flows into the Tiber, he was a neutral observer. He was a journalist, but his documentation of what happened clearly shows that there was a struggle for which direction the council was going to go in theologically. Would it go in more of a liberal or leftist direction, or would it go more traditional? And it seems that the leftward tilting bishops, they succeeded largely in shaping the council to fit their views. Now, by comparison with some of the things going on today, the Second Vatican Council is traditional by comparison, but at the time it was controversial for that. In the second area, the controversy was how it was implemented and how so many people suffered as a result of this abrupt change that was not explained, and things were done in the name of the spirit of the Second Vatican Council that had nothing to do with the Vatican Council. Things that were done that had no basis in the documents, and yet they were foisted upon the people, and it caused a lot of angst, a lot of problems. So we're still, all these years later, we're still suffering the repercussions of that disorientation that took place. A lot of it having to do with people who wanted to take the council and run with it and do things that it never envisioned. So those are my thoughts on the topic, Colin. Important one, to be sure. I'm glad you called. I'll be right back with more right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Real life solutions you can believe in. Yeah! The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah! We're going to California. We're going to South Dakota and Texas and New York.
Let it run, Cyrus.
Texas and New York. Yeah!
Let it run.
And Oregon and Washington and Oregon and Washington. We're going to South Dakota.
My favorite part about this song, Cyrus, is the bass. That bass is just flashing.
It's actually really good.
It's really good. And it's just one note. You know, it's just, he's just jamming on one note.
It works.
All right. The gift that keeps on giving. Howard Dean, everybody. Let's go to, where are we going? Albuquerque to talk to Jackson. Hello, Jackson.
Hello, Patrick.
Yes, sir. Welcome.
I have a comment on the Department of Defense extremism stand-down day you were talking about earlier from the Air Force side. Mm-hmm. I've read through the training that we have, and there's a number of discussion topics that you could go through. Most of them are pretty generic. You know, you're in the Air Force, you shouldn't do these things. But there's two in particular that I wanted to mention to you.
Are you in the Air Force?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
One of them is a very in-depth guided module on how the steps that someone takes to go from being a normal person to being a radical extremist.
Okay.
And the other one is a very legalistic document of if you see these behaviors, you must report them. Okay. And the latter is required training in the Air Force. And the former, most places aren't going to discuss it at all, which just speaks to me about how much of a witch hunt this whole thing is.
Give me some specifics.
So, the legalistic document, it goes very in-depth defining these are the behaviors that if you see them, you know, you have to bring them up to your superiors. You have to report them. Like, if you see someone paying dues to any listed organization, or if you see them attending rallies of certain organizations, or if they say certain things, you have to report that to your superiors.
What are some of the organizations on the list? Anything that would shock us? I mean, if you said the KKK and, you know, if you listed groups like that, I wouldn't be the least surprised. In fact, I would support that. But are there any groups listed on that list that we would be shocked by because they're anything but extremist groups?
No, thankfully. They didn't mention, you know, evangelicals or Catholics at all, which I'm very proud to say about the Air Force. But
that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what else do you want to tell me? Or was that it, or did you have more to it?
I just wanted to tell you that from what I'm seeing, the priority with this whole training thing is not to actually fix the problem. It is to find the problem and try and excise it from the Air Force, which is just reminds me of, you know, the practices in communist USSR where people had to report on their neighbors if they were doing, you know, anti-communist things.
Yeah, that's snitch culture. Where you rat people out. So my next question, Jackson, is I don't know if this is part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice or if that's, you know, if there's a separate code that governs this kind of thing. But are there other aspects that have nothing to do with ideology, let's say nothing to do with politics or anything like that? But in the armed forces, are there requirements to report on a, you know, a fellow enlisted man if you see something? You know, I mean, can you give me any examples if there are such things? Because I wonder if, and I never served in the military, but I wonder if there are some legitimate ways in which the government says, if you see this, you have to report it.
Yeah, so in the training that I saw, and there's other things too, a lot of stuff with, you know, sexual assault and that sort of thing. Right. Which,
so if
of
it's
course,
a crime, you obviously have to report it. That makes sense, yeah.
Right. But in this document in particular, association with certain extremist groups, and I think the Proud Boys might have been on the list. I'm not entirely certain. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the KKK is definitely on there, and all those other, Hamas and Al-Qaeda, all those are on there. If you associate with them, you know, you're paying dues to them, you're going to rallies, you're supporting them in you know, online or vocally, that has to be reported.
I'm fine with that. So there's nothing, they don't say, like, you know, right to life groups or, you know, traditional family groups or anything. So those are not specifically identified or listed in that, in what you've seen, right?
In what I've seen, no. They're being very careful to not try to offend, you know, a majority of people. They're trying to
That's good.
Only list those that pretty much everyone can agree on.
That's good. So if are you, my last question, if you're in active duty right now, what is the morale like, and has it changed in the last several months, or is it about the same? How would you describe from what you've seen?
From what I've seen, because ever since the COVID situation started, morale has been pretty low because they're keeping everybody indoors, keeping everything on lockdown. You know, it's a lot like what COVID restrictions elsewhere, but it's even worse perhaps on these military bases because of, you know, you can be a little bit more strict about it.
Yeah, I bet. And they have more authority to enforce it.
Yes.
Would it be fair to assume that most people on active duty have been vaccinated by now?
It depends on where you are. Over at the base that I'm at, they're actually being very slow about it. I haven't heard anything from our medical group.
That's interesting. I would find it. I would have guessed that the military would have been among the first groups of people that would get the mass vaccinations. But okay. Well, Jackson, thank you. I appreciate your contribution to the conversation today. And thank you for doing what you do. Let's go to. No, I don't think we can. It wouldn't be fair to put somebody on the air and then yank them back off again in 30 seconds. So those of you who are holding, thanks for your patience. Just stand by. And I'll be coming to you on the other side of this quick timeout. It won't be very long. The number to dial is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I have some information I want to share with you on the way back. This is a new study, and I'll tell you what they say. If you have this in your life, you have a much higher chance of living a longer, healthier life. And this one thing seems to be a common denominator among a lot of people who live longer and healthier. I'll tell you what that one thing is, and I hope that you've got it, and if you don't, maybe I'll give you some suggestions on how you can get it. It's not religion, by the way. If you think that's what I'm going to tell you, it's not that. I'll be right back, and I'll tell you the answer to that right after this. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, Patrick, tell us.